That was Leaper James with the tune Wake Up Spring from Magic Seeds. Before this, we heard Marconi Union with Strata from Signals. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. If you missed a show or you want to get in touch with me, my website is at djfirefly.com.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak about the homeless crisis in New York City and around the country. It's huge. On any one night, 130,000 people are homeless in New York City. 90% of them are black or Latino.
Homelessness is not the fault of the homeless. It's not a moral issue. It's a problem that can be addressed and solved. Give people homes and services if they need them. We'll also look at the bold imperialistic attack when the United States military kidnapped the president of Venezuela and his wife, taking them to New York City on the preposterous charges that they were narco traffickers.
Subjecting Venezuela has been a long-time project of the right wing in our country, who want to take their oil and natural resources, control their government, and bring down the government of Cuba as well.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Being homeless is not a reflection on the inadequacy of a person. It is not a moral issue, even though right-wing figures like Trump's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor of New York City, and Andrew Cuomo, who had hoped to be mayor, maintained that essentially cruel position. They were against giving people subsidized homes and treatment if they required it for health problems, addiction problems, or job training. Homelessness is a consequence of housing affordability, inequality, systemic racism, and pro-capitalist government policies. It is more profitable for the real estate industry to build housing for the rich rather than for the poor. There's more profit in luxury housing, not so much in working-class housing. New York City is the greatest example of homelessness that exists throughout the USA. On any one night, 130,000 people sleep in shelters. 90% of them are black or Latino. One out of seven children in New York City public schools are homeless. Our guest, Patrick Marquis, has written a powerful, moving, common-sense account. His book, Placeless, Homelessness in the New Gilded Age, is an eloquent rendering of the plight of human beings who don't have a home. They don't have a place in our world. Mr. Marquis has more than 20 years of experience working as an advocate for homeless people in New York City, and he's worked across the country. He's just published his book. It's perfectly titled, Placeless, Homelessness in the New Gilded Age. Mr. Marquis is a former Deputy Executive Director for Advocacy at the Coalition for Homeless, New York City's premier homeless advocacy organization. He's a former member of the Board of Directors at the National Coalition for Homeless. He's the author of numerous research studies on homelessness and housing policy. He lives in New York City. Patrick Marquis, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael, and thank you for having me back on the program.
Patrick, I'd like to start off this interview by asking you about the title of your book, Placeless, Homelessness in the New Gilded Age. What do you mean by placeless? Is that more than homeless?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me that question, Michael, because one of the major reasons I wrote the book is that I wanted to dispel some of the myths and fundamental misunderstandings around homelessness. And one of them, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier in your introduction, is that homelessness and homeless people are often treated as a problem of sort of personal dysfunction or, you know, people who are some kind of peculiar sort of subspecies of urban poverty. it often gets treated as a social work problem instead of what it actually is, which is a problem of housing affordability. It's a systemic problem. The argument I try and make in the book is that homelessness, or the period of homelessness that we've been living in since the late 1970s, early 1980s, which I refer to as modern mass homelessness, is actually sort of the tip of the iceberg of a sort of wider epidemic of displacement that is happening throughout the economy and throughout society. So obviously homelessness is kind of the most visible of this kind of, you know, form of extreme displacement, but you see it also in terms of displacement in neighborhoods in the form of gentrification, where sort of long-term residents and tenants of neighborhoods end up getting displaced in favor of more affluent, you know, sort of white newcomers. You see it in terms of economic displacement, the structural changes in the U.S. economy and in U.S. capitalism that have occurred since the 1970s, where manufacturing jobs have gone away. We've seen deindustrialization. Many more sort of precarious service sector jobs have been created with much less stability. And then finally, you see it in the form of mass migration internationally. You know, we've certainly experienced that over the last several decades of newcomers coming to the United States from Latin America and Asia and Africa, many of them driven by climate change, many of them driven by economic dislocation. And all these forms of displacement really have something in common. You know, the structural economic changes, again, that we've seen in this period since the 1970s, the rise again of xenophobia and systemic racism as a reaction to newcomers coming, but also, you know, the sort of historic problems, the historic legacy of racism in the United States, and the political changes that we've seen, the rise of neoliberal economic policies, of right-wing politics and policies. And all of that have contributed to this kind of crisis, this epidemic of displacement, of which homelessness is really just the most obvious example.
Well, Patrick, geographically, where do people who are placeless sleep at night? Talk to us about the armories, tunnels, intake centers, Bellevue Hospital, and Manhattan Park, for example.
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question, because when I was writing the book, one of the things that I wanted to do was actually sort of situate the problem of homelessness in terms of specific urban spaces where you find homeless people. Much of the book focuses on New York City, but I also, you know, look at other cities across the country too, that sort of, you know, for good and bad reasons ended up taking the New York City example. But here in New York City, you know, we've seen the problems of homelessness kind of surround certain kind of urban spaces. So I write in the book, for instance, about Madison Square Park, a park in downtown Manhattan that in the mid-1990s became kind of the epicenter of the wave of police crackdowns on street homelessness that occurred under former Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, which was, you know, again, part of a national wave of criminalization of homelessness that kind of emerged out of the late 1980s and the early 1990s, a period that I refer to in the book as kind of the backlash era, when you know, the city governments and particularly sort of right-wing politicians and political figures like Giuliani decided to really crack down on homelessness. And what happened in Madison Square Park, aside from the incredible harm and damage that occurred to the people that I met there and was working with and the homeless folks there, was that it triggered a wave of hyper-gentrification of that park and of that surrounding neighborhood, where luxury towers were built. You know, just incredible amounts of economic wealth and real estate wealth were created in part as a result of the displacing of these homeless people from the park. The other, I think, good example is armories. One of the things I talk about a lot in the book is how the current era that we're in, what I call the new Gilded Age, really harkens back to the Gilded Age of the late 19th century, early 20th century in the United States. The armories, which were built at that time, were actually built at the behest of urban elites and political figures who wanted to suppress worker uprisings that were happening at that time in an era of incredible inequality. The Brooklyn trolley strike, other kind of railroad strikes, any of these sort of worker uprisings were literally suppressed by militias, which were being quartered and housed in the armories that were being built all across New York City at the time. Those armories, ironically, and this is a huge historical irony, in the 1980s became shelters for the rising homeless population that occurred in that decade and continue to be used as kind of warehouse-style shelters for homeless people, many of whom are now the urban working class, the urban poor, struggling to make ends meet, trying to keep a job while living in homeless shelters.
Patrick, why is homelessness the inevitable consequence of economic shifts inaugurated in the Reagan era?
The Reagan administration really was kind of the beginning on a national level of the kind of right-wing neoliberal economic policies that we saw take hold not only in the United States, but across the world, and certainly in Europe under Thatcher and other political leaders. We saw the same things happen. It really was kind of a toxic mixture of funding cutbacks to safety net programs, which had protected kind of the poorest folks in this country from the harshest realities of economic dislocation that comes under capitalism, the sort of swings of recession to growth to recession. Specifically, Reagan instituted the largest, most draconian cutbacks in federal housing programs that we've ever seen under his 8 years as president, an 80% cut in the budget authority for the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development and for the housing programs that served as sort of a cushion for the poorest Americans. And we've never really recovered from those cutbacks. Right now, only 1 in 5 American households that actually qualifies for federal housing assistance is actually receiving it. So we've still been sort of struggling under these neoliberal policies. It's interesting also to note, I think, that in many ways the neoliberal politics and policies that we saw instituted on the national level under Reagan were really workshopped in New York City in the 1970s in the midst of the fiscal crisis. You know, at the time, New York City lost hundreds of thousands of jobs, lost an enormous amount of its population. Many of those jobs were manufacturing jobs, huge economic dislocation, which led to budget deficits. And the mixture of banks and the federal government pressured New York City into austerity measures, which cut back dramatically on housing programs, on other safety net programs, on health and education programs. And that sort of, again, that model of austerity government, of neoliberal policymaking, really became the template for what we saw at the national level and has continued in the recent decades.
Please talk to us about worsening inequality, housing affordability, systemic racism, and neoliberal government policies which have caused homelessness in America.
One of the reasons I subtitled the book Homelessness in the New Gilded Age is that the current period that we're living in really does have so many of the main features of the original Gilded Age of the late 19th century. One of them, of course, is radical inequality. We've just never seen levels of inequality exist in the United States that we have now since that period more than 100 years ago. We're just a very, very small percentage of people control about half the wealth in this country. And we've seen working class and low income folks have their incomes stagnated or actually drop over this period from roughly the 1980s to the present. We've also seen, just a rise in xenophobia in response to the increasing numbers of immigrants that have arrived in this country, and backlash racism coming out of the 1970s, where there had been some progress made, in the wake of the civil rights movement. We've just seen sort of once again this kind of backlash racist economic policies and political policies and social policies kind of emerging and continuing over recent decades. Obviously, much of this culminates in Trump, right? Trump is kind of almost the kind of perfect example of this kind of rise of a toxic mixture of neoliberal economic policies and sort of xenophobia and racism and just in a much more kind of open and blatant form that we've seen recently. And this is, really, I think, at the heart of what we, what we see is the current problem of mass homelessness, because what it has done, those economic policies and then the economic shifts in the economy have really led to a widening housing affordability gap. That's the sort of gap between the cost of of housing, mostly rent, you know, apartment rents for people in cities, and the incomes of low-income and working-class folks in the city. And that gap has gotten wider and wider. I mean, here in New York City, we've lost 500,000 apartments, which would be affordable to very low-income households in the city just in the current century. And across the country, you know, we've seen a situation where, you know, as I said earlier, only 1 in 5 households that qualifies for federal housing programs actually is able to obtain those programs. At the same time, we have an incredible shortfall in affordable housing, where in some of the cities in this country that have the same kinds of housing affordability problems that New York City has, and I'm speaking here about, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Austin, Texas, Atlanta, Boston, Washington, D.C., you know, these cities where there's just incredible gaps between the availability of affordable rental housing and the incomes of the people that can actually afford it. And on every level, we've seen government just stepping back from creating affordable housing and providing the kinds of housing assistance in the form of rental assistance, which is really needed.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall, and we're speaking with Patrick Marquis about his new book, Placeless: Homelessness in the New Gilded Age. Patrick, why is homelessness not a moral issue? You use the analogy in your book about the children's game, musical chairs. And could you elaborate on that for us, please?
Yes. I mean, this was really actually one of the kind of metaphors that helped me kind of understand the kind of systemic issues around homelessness in such a clear way. A colleague of mine, who's actually one of the co-founders of Coalition for the Homeless, was the first to tell me about this, a brilliant anthropologist named Kim Hopper. And it's this notion, if you think about the old game of musical chairs, and, you know, kids are sort of walking around in a circle while the music plays, and then they have to fight to get into the chairs, and there's always one fewer chair than there are kids, and they keep taking chairs away as each round of the game continues. That's a really, in many ways, a perfect illustration of the problem of homelessness. It's not about the kids. It's about the housing units, in the sense, the chairs, in the metaphor, that are being taken away each time. And what we've seen, again, over the last several decades, has been loss of affordable rental housing that is affordable, that's, you know, accessible to the lowest income households in this country, and also loss of, you know, federal housing assistance, of, you know, of any kind of government, you know, aid to step into the breach that the private market is not creating enough affordable housing and never will. And that's, again, I think one of the reasons why you have to sort of cut against this myth that homelessness is a problem of sort of personal pathology or personal dysfunction. So many of our sort of right-wing politicians, whether it's Rudy Giuliani when he was mayor in the 90s in New York, or Andrew Cuomo when he was governor of New York State, tried to become mayor again in New York City this past year, or Trump as sort of a perfect example, try to portray the problem as one of personal pathology. They try and portray homeless people as sort of broken, dysfunctional people who are not housing ready or not able to obtain homes or need to be sort of fixed or, you know, or somehow different than other people. They try to personalize the problem or create a sort of moral dimension to the problem instead of talking about the systemic issues that are really there. And it's just a way, you know, again, of kind of disguising the issue and kind of hiding what's really going on. What I actually found interesting when I was doing research for the book was that this is in no way kind of a new line of discourse. Back during the Gilded Age that I spoke of earlier, there were attempts to also pathologize the kind of the first examples of homeless people that we started to see as the country was urbanizing and industrializing in the late 19th century. So the so-called hobos and tramps of that period of time, there was an entire literature that attempted to kind of pathologize that group of homeless, mostly homeless men of that era. And even some of the early founders of the eugenics movement in the United States actually did some of the early kind of like literature trying to describe these people as genetically inferior or, you know, somehow disordered individuals to explain, you know, to try and, you know, create a false explanation for their homelessness instead of looking at the enormous problems of inequality and economic dislocation that was occurring at that time.
Do you think placelessness is going to increase?
Well, I think it's absolutely to be expected right now under what we just know, you know, just to speak, you know, very narrowly of the problem of homelessness in the United States. I mean, right now, the last federal estimates we have for the homeless population, and this comes from, I think, in 2024, in the last year of the Biden administration, we had around 770,000 people estimated to be homeless on a given night. Now, that is certainly an undercount. We know from the way the federal government makes, you know, kind of produces these estimates that it's an undercount, but it was the highest estimate that they had ever produced at that time. We also know from other research and other data that in the course of a year, as many as 3 to 4 million people experience homelessness. And that doesn't even count the roughly 3.5 million what I call hidden homeless people. So people who are living doubled up or in severely overcrowded housing, who are, you know, effectively homeless as well. Those numbers are almost certainly going to rise simply if you just look at the immediate policy proposals of the Trump administration. Recently, the Trump administration attempted to alter or eliminate funding through its homeless services grants that currently provides housing assistance to about 170,000 people in a range of programs that are called supportive housing, which is combining subsidized housing with support services. Trump administration wants to eliminate that funding, and that could again lead to as many as 170,000 formerly homeless people becoming homeless again. But also through the main federal housing programs like public housing and the federal housing voucher program, which are the sort of the two largest federal housing programs, the administration has proposed a series of changes that would cut back on funding or take those programs and convert them into block grants to states, which would allow states, particularly in conservative states, to, you know, kind of change or reduce the funding for those programs in a way that could, and some experts believe, could lead to as many as 4 million Americans losing their housing as a result of those proposals. So it's almost inevitable that we're going to see an increase in homelessness under this administration.
Patrick, you live in New York City. You've got friends who have the ear of the new mayor. What would you recommend to the Democratic Socialist Mayor Mamdani for what to do when he starts tackling the problem of homelessness in New York City?
The times we're living in are extraordinarily bleak, but I think one sign of hope has been Mamdani's campaign and his election as mayor, and we're in the early days. So we'll see what's to come. I mean, he hasn't yet set out a kind of comprehensive plan to deal with homelessness nor to deal with affordable housing, although the signs are pretty good. You know, we've seen an enormous increase in street homelessness in recent years, and that's largely because of just incredible shortfall in funding for this model of housing I referred to as supportive housing, which is often also, kind of another version of it is housing first, which is the notion that we could take folks immediately from the streets, put them into subsidized apartments that they can afford, and then provide support services, mental health professionals, or folks with addiction treatment, you know, backgrounds, or, you know, other kinds of support services to them in their homes to help them maintain their stability. That model of housing is extraordinarily successful. It was actually pioneered here in New York City in the 1980s, replicated across the country, and has led to enormous reductions in homelessness in other cities around the country, from everywhere from Salt Lake City to Houston to here in New York City. Enormous reductions in homelessness among military veterans over the past couple of decades. It's under attack by the Trump administration, but New York City and New York State have the resources to invest in this housing. They've done it in the past, and they need to do it in a really, really significant way if we're going to tackle the problem of street homelessness. In terms of homeless families, the city needs to do a lot more than previous mayoral administrations have done to invest in deeply affordable housing for the poorest families in the city, including families that are in our shelter system. I mean, right now we have more than 100,000 people a night sleeping in New York City shelters. 35,000 of them are children. About two-thirds of our nightly shelter population is families. So again, cutting across the stereotype and myths of who's homelessness, the majority of people who are homeless in New York City right now are in families. 90% of them are Black or Latino. And, you know, according to like an analysis that I did when I was a Coalition for the Homeless, you know, back about 10 or 15 years ago, you know, one out of every 17 black children in this city ends up experiencing homelessness in the course of a year because of the legacy of systemic racism and the problems of housing affordability, which are so particularly that hit black and Latino communities so hard in New York City. So we need to be investing the city housing dollars, the dollars that are invested in city housing programs need to be invested in deeply affordable housing that's affordable to those poorest families.
Well, speaking of families, if I may ask you a personal question, please tell us why you dedicated your book to your mother.
Oh, well, thank you so much for asking me that question. I mean, my mother passed away a few years ago. She was just a remarkable woman, a school teacher, you know, and struggled with, she had a chronic health problem, a heart disease, a heart valve disease that resulted from her catching a rheumatic fever when she was a teenager. And had sort of lived with that heart disease her whole life and really, you know, struggled with it. But then, you know, I managed to live into her early 80s. You know, she was from a small city town west of Cleveland, Ohio, where I grew up. And, you know, even though she came from in many ways a very conventional and kind of conservative Catholic background, she managed to kind of have incredible empathy and sympathy for people who are different and people who are struggling. And I think that's something that she taught me and she taught my brother and, you know, taught our family. And a simple woman who was also remarkable in her way. And it just meant so much to me to be able to dedicate the book to her. I don't think I would have, you know, I certainly wouldn't have be where I am or my life wouldn't be what it was without her.
Patrick, how can people get your book, Placeless, Homelessness in the New Gilded Age? And how can people follow your work?
Oh, well, thank you so much, Michael. I mean, the book, Placeless, is available in bookshops and booksellers online. You can get it at bookshop.org, which is really, you know, one of the great online places to buy books because it supports independent bookstores. The publisher is Melville House, which is just a wonderful publisher. You can also find ways to buy the book from their website as well. I'm not somebody who has a big presence on social media or anything, but I'm going to be doing some writing in the future and some events talking about the book. But, you know, more important, I think, trying to talk about the issue and the solutions to the problem of homelessness that are out there and what we need to do to struggle to confront this problem.
Well, Patrick Marquis, Maria Hall and I thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder Radio. You take it easy.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael and Maria.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and gone? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on?
Barely into the new year, in the early morning hours of January 3rd, the Trump administration illegally and brutally attacked Venezuela, kidnapping the president and his wife. 80 people were killed in the attack, including 32 Cuban soldiers. Nicolas Maduro and his wife, attorney Celia Flores, were flown to a Brooklyn jail. The plan is to try them in the U.S. District Court in Lower Manhattan on the laughable pretext that they are drug runners and their country stole American oil. And further, according to President Trump, hordes of Venezuelan murderers and rapists have been released across U.S. borders to ravage American citizens. That next morning, we awoke to the arrogant boasting of Trump and his Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, whose body is tattooed with a huge Crusader cross, that they plan to run Venezuela, make lots of money, reclaim their oil, and give it to multinational corporations such as ExxonMobil to exploit. The United Nations was organized after World War II to prevent such actions. Aggressive war was outlawed. The War Powers Act was passed by the U.S. Congress a half century ago, precisely to prevent secret aggression against foreign countries, and required congressional approval, which was not sought or obtained prior to this invasion. Protests against the aggression continue across the United States. People took to the streets, remembering how the war in Iraq, which killed 1 million people, was fought allegedly because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which is now known to be a lie. We're joined by returning guest Jeff Mackler. He's the national secretary of the U.S. political party Socialist Action and its candidate for the U.S. presidency in 2016 and 2020. Jeff is also a member of the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC. Jeff is the author of 20 books and pamphlets, including CIA Crack in America, A Detailed History of the U.S. Government and Its Agent Oliver North, Importing Tons of Crack Cocaine from the Colombian Medellin Cartel to Sell in Los Angeles, Raising Funds Illegally for the Nicaraguan Contras. Jeff Mackler, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, Maria and Mike Smith, I'm honored to be with you today. Thank you.
The Trump administration has the position what they did was an act of law enforcement, that Maduro and his wife are narco-terrorists. How do you appreciate this claim?
Well, President Trump is doing today, overtly, exactly what the United States has been doing literally for a century. Let me remind your listeners that the United States has 1,100 military bases in 110 countries around the world. U.S. troops are there to extract the resources of poor countries. They force these countries to sign contracts. When you talk about President Trump claiming that he owns Venezuelan oil, leaving aside the legalities that when oil was nationalized decades ago and fully paid for, the United States, by force and violence, imposes laws on countries around the world that require them to give up their resources. So, for example, in Cuba, the United States government, at the time in the 50s when the Secretary of State and the CIA director were both owners of the United Fruit Company, they were angry at the Cubans for daring to nationalize their own resources. The same thing with every country. The United States organized a coup in 1954 in Venezuela and overthrew the democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz, and proceeded to make war on that country in alliance with their imposed dictator, Rios Montt, that killed 400,000 indigenous Mayan people in Guatemala. United States intervened in Cuba, supporting the dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista, and killed 50,000 people. They intervened in Nicaragua and murdered by supporting the Somoza dictatorship. They supported the Chilean dictatorship, which killed 60,000 Chileans. So the record of the United States as a foreign power intervening to protect its, quote, interests, is unprecedented. And Trump arguing that he owns Venezuelan oil, not to mention Congolese resources and the resources of Africa and Latin America, are nothing but blatant lies.
Jeff Mackler, the Trump administration has not been restrained by international law, abroad or domestic law at home. Please talk about the United Nations Charter and aggressive war.
Well, the United Nations Charter has all kinds of statements that say you're not allowed to invade other countries, that the right of poor and oppressed nations to self-determination is paramount, that no nation can invade and take over the resources of another country. But the United Nations is bound by the Security Council decisions. And no matter what the written text of the United Nations Charter and related documents is, it requires a unanimous decision of the Security Council. So, for example, every time a resolution is introduced opposing the violation of Cuban sovereignty, the United States vetoes it. even though the vote in the United States, in the United Nations, is something like 154 nations to two, two being the United States and Israel. So the United Nations is today considered by most people a relic of the imperialist World War II. No one gives a darn what its resolutions are. The United Nations condemned the genocide in Palestine through a UN-related organization. And meanwhile, the United States ignored it with impunity. So international law, according to Trump, is what the United States government says it is, and no one has recourse to the United Nations to change it, because the United States can veto any resolution with one vote.
Jeff Mackler, what are your thoughts about the Trump administration's disregard of the United States Constitution with respect to Congress having to declare war and the War Powers Act of 52 years ago? Is our constitutional system of checks and balances now a dead letter?
Maria, I have to say absolutely. So the United States intervenes everywhere regardless of the Constitution. And every time something comes up which raises a constitutional question, the Congress, usually in a bipartisan mode, vetoes it or refuses. So there has never been, to my knowledge, in the history of the recent history, at least, of the United States, any vote in Congress preventing the United States from intervening. The United States is intervening in the Congo. The United States intervened in, as you said, the Iraq war. They did that in order to steal the resources of Iraq. The United States conducted a 10-year Iraq-Iran war that killed 1 million Iraqis and 900,000 Iranians. And the United States Congress did absolutely nothing. But the end result was the United States corporations ended up controlling the resources of Iran and considerable amounts in Iraq.
Jeff, what's the Monroe Doctrine? And what does Trump mean by his current Donroe Doctrine?
The Monroe Doctrine was the classic doctrine of American imperialism that basically said that Latin America was in the U.S. backyard and the United States has a right to intervene, steal the resources and everything else. And that's what happened. The history of Latin America is a history of U.S. interventions to impose dictators who meet the needs of American imperialism. That's what happened in Cuba under Batista. That's what happened in Chile, in Bolivia, in Guatemala, and every other country. If you look at the details, United States corporations owns it. When the United States intervened in Cuba, John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State and Alan Dulles was the CIA director. Their corporations literally owned the United Fruit Corporations, which had stolen the resources in Latin America. It's the same thing everywhere on Earth. Let me give you one classic example. When Africa was divided up by the colonial powers at the turn of the last century, at that point, my dad had given me a map of Africa. And since it was like an 8-foot by 4-foot map, I was sort of compelled to look at it every night before I went to sleep. And the way it read was Belgian Congo, British Rhodesia, Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, Portuguese Angola, Spanish Sahara, Spanish Morocco. That is, the entire African continent was divided up by the imperialists. The weakest of the imperialist powers was Belgium, headed by King Leopold II. And he literally took control of the major resource of the Congo, which was called the Belgian Congo. And before it was called the Belgian Congo, it was the personal colony of King Leopold. King Leopold conducted the largest genocide in the history of the world. slaughtering 12 million Congolese people. But one little fact that is not very well known is that the underground resources of the Congo, perhaps the richest in all of Africa, went to two Americans, J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller, who today are the owners of the biggest bank, perhaps, in the world, J.P. Morgan Chase. They own the Congolese resources. And the battles that are taking place today are a continuation of a U.S. intervention, imperialist control that started literally over a century ago. The same corporations, the same banks, like Chevron, for example, is a major owner of Venezuelan resources. These countries don't have a choice. When the Nicaraguans, for example, made a revolution in 1979, my estimate is that the UN U.S. ambassador went to talk to Daniel Ortega, who I met in Nicaragua, and basically said, "Mr. Ortega, congratulations on overthrowing the Somoza government. It was a well-known dictatorship. But if you dare take the Cuban route, if you dare take control of your own resources, you will face the isolation, embargo, blockade, and assassinations that we have imposed on the Cubans. So watch your step."
Well, speaking of Cuba, Venezuela has been a lifeline for the country. What does the subordination of Venezuela mean for Cuba's viability as a sovereign nation?
The United States has never respected the sovereignty of Cuba. Interestingly enough, about 20-some-odd years ago, I was the organizer of a conference at UC Berkeley called Dialogue with Cuba. It was the first institutionally sponsored conference in the history of the United States on Cuba, and Obama was the president. The Pope had visited Cuba and met with Fidel Castro, and there was a momentary freeze. It included the United States agreeing to release the Cuban Five, and these were Cubans who had infiltrated the CIA apparatus that was aimed at overthrowing, bombing, and subordinating Cuba to the United States. But one interesting fact, the Cuban government gave the Obama administration and the CIA a list of the attempted assassinations on the Cuban president, Fidel Castro. And they gave him a list of 37 times that U.S. government agents tried to murder the president of Cuba. Obama took it and gave it to the CIA head, who did his own investigations at a time when there was a bit of a freeze. And the CIA said literally, "Well, we can only account for about 27 of the assassination attempts." That is what we saw in Venezuela last week, except it was done openly. The Cuban assassination attempts, admitted to by the United States, were done clandestinely through secret agents, through bombs, through poisons. Castro never slept in the same room more than one day for his entire reign. It's no coincidence that the Venezuelans used Cubans to defend President Maduro, because they knew full well the experience of assassinating, kidnapping, murdering the heads of state. So you can imagine the strength of the instant attacks with helicopters and gunships and bombings that took place a few days ago. This is the most powerful nation on earth, and it overcame, and by the way, murdered something like 32 Cubans who were defending Venezuela. And what did Venezuela get in return? The Cubans gave them a profoundly progressive educational system. They gave them defense of their president, which didn't prove to be very helpful. And they gave them all kinds of scientific advances that the Cuban government has been able to achieve because it cut its ties with American imperialism. So the Cubans have been, for a half century, victims of American imperialism attack. including an overt attack where the United States sent from Dominican Republic thousands of U.S.-backed troops to invade Cuba and take over. The Cubans defeated that intervention and in the course of it captured the entire U.S.-backed invasion force. The United States had to admit that they did it, and they organized a trade. The United States gave Cuba the medical supplies to inoculate the entire Cuban population against common diseases like polio and cholera and flu and mumps and measles and so on. And the Cubans returned the captured CIA agents. But following that intervention, the Cubans, quote, nationalized, Fidel speaking, the Cuban bourgeoisie down to the nails in the boots of their shoes. But did he pay for it? He absolutely did. What he did was he looked at the holdings of all U.S. corporations and the taxes they paid and the declared value of all U.S. corporations. Of course, the American crooks who owned Cuban wealth and resources had totally underestimated and lied about their taxes, so they paid virtually nothing. But Fidel took them at their word and paid them the full value of American corporations. That was a nationalization that the world understood, but U.S. imperialism never forgave the Cuban people for. So they began to send nuclear weapons to surround Cuba, and the Cubans defended themselves. That history, I'm sure your readers are aware of. The Cubans have every right to self-determination. Their revolution broke from American imperialism and set up the most profound and deep literacy campaign in the world. The Cuban people are the most highly educated in the world. They have the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. They have a medical system with free access to every single person. They have an educational system with free access from the cradle to the grave, including PhDs and doctors. The United States wants to eliminate it all.
I'm here on Law and Disorder Radio with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall. We're speaking with Jeff Mackler about the situation with respect to Venezuela and Maduro. Jeff, China is South America's biggest trading partner. What is China's relationship to South America now that they've snatched Maduro? What will change?
The fact that China, in my opinion, an imperialist power, on the order of the United States, China has 1,000-plus billionaires and something like 10 new billionaires every month. So the Chinese are the largest investors in the resources of Latin America. Because they have the cheapest labor force in the world, they are able to manufacture goods, including telephones and major industrial products, far cheaper than the United States. I remind your listeners that some 25 years ago, it was the United States that allowed China to enter the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And the condition was the Chinese could conduct trade, provided that U.S. could build U.S.-owned factories in China. And at the time the Chinese agreed, they allowed their dormitory factories, which had teenage women working for 80-hour weeks for 6 cents an hour, to operate in the United States. So the United States basically offshored a good deal of their manufacturing industries to China because it was the cheapest labor force on earth. Why in heaven's name, the U.S. imperialists and capitalists and governments said, should we pay union wages to auto workers and steel workers and other unionized sectors of the economy when we can have Chinese labor for virtually nothing? Today, Chinese labor is up from 6 cents an hour to perhaps $1.50 or $2 an hour, far below the wages. That's why the imperialist countries are all investing in China. But the Chinese soon realized that there was no percentage in basically allowing American corporations to produce goods that were competitive on world markets. So the Chinese revised their manufacturing industry and itself became the nation with the most modern technology in the world. And that's why the United States is nervous. China outproduces American imperialism. The United States, which used to control 90% of the imports to Latin America by American corporations, today is down to less than 50%. And the Chinese are the biggest traders. So what you have, in my opinion, is an inter-imperialist rivalry over the world's markets. And by the way, I'll only add that what the United States does to Venezuela is what it does to every nation, including China. It basically says, if you don't accede to our tariffs, which went up to 50%, then we will keep your products out of the country because the United States can't compete. It says the same thing to British imperialism, Chinese imperialism, and every other nation on earth that has a manufacturing technology that is competitive with the United States. So when Trump, who poses as the deal maker, sits down with the Spanish capitalists or the French or the British capitalists, he basically says, we're going to keep your products out of the United States by imposing tariffs that qualitatively increase the cost and to the advantage of American products, unless you back off, unless you give us part of the profits that you make by exploiting American workers. That's why we have an inflation of the United States, because American corporations protected by the government are free to raise their prices to unprecedented amounts for everything, for the most basic coffee and other things. U.S. imperialism says either you bend to our tariffs or we will ban your product from the country. So Trump sits down and makes deals with the leading capitalist powers, not to mention the poorest countries on earth like Venezuela. He basically says to the Venezuelans, we are going to starve you to death, and that's what they did. The starvation in Venezuela reached the point where 8 million people, perhaps a third of the entire population, had to flee because of starvation.
Jeff Meckler, what has been the role of major media coverage, and how has the Democratic Party reacted?
I read an article just yesterday by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And they reported on every single major U.S. corporate-owned media, from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Houston Publications, the Chicago Tribune. And basically, they had Trump's line. They said that Venezuela was a narco-trafficking country, and that the United States had every right to intervene, regardless of the U.S. Constitution, regardless of the United Nations, regardless of any applicable laws. So the American corporate media are in sync with Trump and the Democratic Party. I remind you that it was the previous administration, Joseph Biden, that began a genocidal war that has murdered something like 70,000 people in Palestine. So it's a bipartisan war. The media are jointly controlled by U.S. corporations, and the Democratic Party has been complicit from the very beginning.
What is being done to oppose the Trump administration? And secondly, how can people participate?
Great question. Of course, my party, Socialist Action, which can be found at socialistaction.org, is part of a united front effort to build a massive anti-war social justice movement to demand U.S. hands off Venezuela, no blood for oil, and the $1 trillion military budget, free Maduro. no attacks on any poor and oppressed nation, the right of self-determination. So our view is that we need to build a united, massive, democratic movement of the American people, winning the majority in massive, democratic, peaceful actions in the streets to show, as all the polls do, that we are the majority, not a minority imperialist government headed by Trump. Trump's wars, whether it be against the Palestinian people or the Venezuelan people or the African people, are wars of a minority ruling class that represent the 1% elite. We want to build a massive majority movement in the streets to demand U.S. out now, hands off, free Maduro. Join us. Join the United National Anti-War Coalition, which is planning massive actions across the country. And so far, 100 actions have been called, mostly small, although just in the last week, 1,000 have demonstrated in New York, and another 1,000 have demonstrated in Chicago. We want tens and hundreds of thousands in the streets. Thank you so much. You can contact Socialist Action at socialistaction.org.
Jeff Mackler, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we remember human rights attorney Michael Ratner, founder of Law and Disorder Radio 20 years ago. He was one of the great attorneys of his generation and appreciated worldwide as the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We'll then hear a rare interview from our Lawyers You'll Like series with attorney Peter Weiss, who passed in November 2025. Peter was the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and founder of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. When Michael Ratner died 9 years ago, we produced several shows in his honor. We interviewed clients and colleagues, including Julian Assange, Columbia Law School friend and climate lawyer Eleanor Stein, labor lawyer Richard Levy, and the former head of the ACLU legal department, David Cole. Let's listen.
On January 4th, British Judge Baratzer made her decision on whether to extradite Julian Assange to the USA for trial under the Espionage Act. Julian is the Australian journalist and publisher of truth-telling WikiLeaks. He was headquartered in London when 10 years ago he blew the whistle on the U.S. Army's war crimes in Iraq. He released a video of an American helicopter shooting down 12 civilians in